Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. All right, you guys, welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I'm super excited. You guys, I know we've had a few author interviews before, but this is a pretty big hit. I'm excited to introduce David Robleski. He is the author of The Story of Edgar Sauto and Familiaris. And David comes from a background of dogs, guys. And he has some really interesting insights that he's kind of woven into these books about the power of being a dog breeder. And so this fact that that conversation made him the New York Times bestselling author, to me, is incredibly powerful. And so I want to know your magic. So welcome, David.
We're happy to be here.
Excellent. You know what, guys? You wake up early and you stay up late. And when you have a litter on the ground, sleep is definitely a luxury. You spend your days planning, researching, making sure everything is just right. Your vet team feels like family, and these puppies, they're your heart. When it's time to send them off to their new homes, they deserve to leave with the same protection and love that you've given them from the very start. So that's where Trupanion's Breeder Support Program comes in. Trupanion makes it easy to send your puppies home with immediate pet medical insurance coverage, thanks to their exclusive Go Home Day offer. No waiting periods or paperwork headaches, just simple, seamless protection starting from day one. And it's not just about coverage. When you join Trupanion's free breeder support program, you also get access to litter health insights, buyer education materials, and vet-approved social media content to help you grow your program and connect with your community. You've done the hard work raising healthy, happy puppies. Now let Trupanion help you protect them as they take their first steps into a brand new world. Join Trupanion's free breeder support program today at trupanion.com/puredogtalk. That's trupanion.com/puredogtalk. Trupanion is underwritten in Canada by Accelerant Insurance Company of Canada, or GPIC Insurance Company, and in the United States by American Pet Insurance Company, or ZPIC Insurance Company. So I know I'm not Oprah, like, you know, we were just chatting about your talk with Oprah, so it's not as cool as Oprah, but we have a very interested audience in your specific conversation around dog breeding. That's what these two books are based on. So tell us why that's what you decided to write about.
That's an interesting way to frame it. I'm not sure that novelists in particular have all that much choice in what they're willing to spend years and years writing about. I mean, if this was nonfiction, that would be something you could be kind of rational about. But I think for a novelist, it's much less rational. But for me, it's a pretty easy explanation. I grew up around dogs. My first memory is of our family dog standing next to our family dog, Princess, who's a collie. My folks moved from the Milwaukee area when I was 2 years old. They moved from the Milwaukee area to central Wisconsin, to a very rural part of central Wisconsin. My father's dream was to do the Green Acres thing, where he moves from the city and then he's a farmer. Right. He was a terrible, terrible, terrible farmer. Just he did not succeed. Very quickly did not succeed, but we stayed on the land. So we had this 92-acre farm. We had what seemed to me at the time a gigantic barn and this little farmhouse. And ultimately, my dad ended up working nearby in a town doing the things that he used to do back in Milwaukee, which was working in machine shops. But it gave my mom a chance to do something that she'd always wanted to do, which was to raise dogs. Just always had been a lifelong dream of hers. And so I've never actually done the footwork of tracking down the exact years. But for on the order of 6, maybe 7 years, we converted the barn into a working kennel. They started out raising German Shepherds, essentially kind of apprenticed with another breeder of German Shepherds. Mm-hmm. And then for reasons I don't understand, because I was a kid at the time, they sort of broke with this person. I'm not quite sure why.
Happens a lot in our world.
Yeah. What I picked up was that they thought that that person wasn't being ethical in some way. But I'm a kid. I was 7 or 8 years old. Sure. So ultimately, they ended up raising poodles.
Oh, wow.
Miniatures, not toys and not standards. I always wish they'd had raised standard poodles because mm-hmm. my heart just attaches to bigger dogs. I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know why. And they did that for several years, but we were really poor. And I give them a lot of credit for this. They made the decision that they could not afford to do it right, and they weren't willing to not do it right.
That's beautiful.
And so they outplaced all their dogs eventually. I don't know how. I just remember the day that they came to me and said, okay, we're going to close down the kennel because we can't do this right. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, I understood it. And on the other hand, I was crushed because my job was to socialize the pups, which mm-hmm. just meant playing with the pups. So mm-hmm. I had like the best chores in the world. I helped with the feeding, the watering of the dogs and cleaning the kennels and all that stuff. But mainly it was just a life where I played with pups every day mm-hmm. and sort of taught them that chewing directly on their human friends wasn't necessarily a great idea. So that's just sort of built in. That's like baked into my hardware as far as the way I see the world. I feel like if I'm not with a dog, I'm half blind, if you know what I mean.
I do.
Like when you're in the world with a dog, you're seeing the world through your point of view and through the dog's point of view. Things that look friendly to you look dangerous to them. Things that look interesting to them don't look interesting to you. Very
I'm
often.
I'm really interested in that pile of poopy. I'm just saying.
Patch of grass that seems completely undifferentiated from other patch of grass has to be investigated. Mm. And that fascinates me because ultimately where I went in my life is I ended up getting a computer science degree. And I promise you that the story actually, the loop closes, but it takes a little bit. I ended up becoming very interested in programming. I got a computer science degree. But the part of computer science I was quite interested in was the part where we're making tools for people to do things that they're passionate about. And the question is, as a designer of user interfaces, is how do you make something that helps someone, that actually improves their quality of life in the largest possible sense, like enables them to achieve things that they couldn't achieve otherwise? And to me, that's the same sort of thing that's going on with dogs. The sort of primal connection that we have with dogs, to me, fundamentally is about how to live a larger, better life in a really broad sense.
Well, and one of the things that you mention kind of like in the theme of the novels is the importance of creating something lasting and beautiful in the world. The idea that yeah. you're pursuing one impossible thing. And let me tell you, as someone who has been breeding dogs since I was a child with my family and still am today, that basically defines our life. So talk to us a little bit through how you came to that and how you incorporated that into your novels.
I think that there's only a couple of things that are worth writing about in the largest sense, and one of them is love. And so I would hope that everything that I write is at some level, and hopefully multiple levels, a love story. But one of those love stories is the love of what you're trying to do in the world with your life. I mean, we all need to pay the bills. There are plenty of things that are just functional things about day-to-day living. But there's also the larger meaning of what you're doing with your life. And I've been lucky enough to work with people in a number of different realms that are lucky enough to be able to say, I'm trying to do something that's bigger than just me. I'm not just trying to pay the mortgage. I'm trying to do something bigger than just me. And one of the things that readers of Familiaris will run across partway through the book is a sort of accounting, a very strange chapter that requires a little patience, but it's a sort of accounting of this couple, John and Mary Sawtelle. Familiaris is about the sort of history of this kennel where everything takes place later for the story of Edgar Sawtelle. But just an accounting of how all the work that they've done over the course of 40 years of raising dogs and placing them in the world, how that has accumulated and what the net effect across all human society has been, even though they're a little kennel in the North Woods, very remote, and they are dedicated to raising this fictional breed of dogs that are extraordinarily good at companionship. And what that actually means is a bit up to the reader. I try to underspecify that. So I feel like every time a dog gets placed with a thoughtful owner, that person's life has been changed forever.
Yeah.
We just lost one of our two dogs in May, and it was driven home to me yet again how she, her name is Pi, and how profoundly she changed our life. Mm-hmm. And every owner I've ever talked to, even owners that I wouldn't call like people who are seriously into dog culture or anything like that, we all can't stop talking about our dogs because Right. Something happens that's absolutely magical that makes them central to our life. I mean, I just can't imagine my life without Pi having been in it. So,
well, and I think what you're expressing is something that those of us who do breed dogs constantly feel. Like my entire chosen family, for example, is people who bought a dog for me, continued my breeding program on, showed dogs with me, competed against, right? That's my entire chosen family. My world is Right. Surrounded by these people who are deeply impactful to my life. And that is true of all of us that are involved in this world. And the fact that you were able to bring that forward and put it into a novel, I think is just unbelievably cool. One of the things that you talk about with the dogs is the inherited versus learned, right? The concept mm-hmm. of what our dogs have. Talk us through kind of where you went for your sources on that and what your takeaway was on that. Because this is something that impacts all of us that breed dogs.
You bet. I started writing Edgar in the mid-90s and mm-hmm. being in touch with the sort of literature in the psychology world and so on. One of the things I was shocked by at that time was how dogs at that time were considered not good subjects for animal psychology research because there was a sense somehow that they were tainted because they were domesticated animals, which seems crazy. It feels crazy right now to say that. But right about that time, so I read a book by a woman named Vicki Hearn called Adam's Task. Very interesting woman. She's passed away in the 2000s at some point, very early, unfortunately. She was a trainer. She was also a philosopher, and she was deeply interested in the development of the way she thought about it was the development of a language between the animal that you're working with and yourself in which questions can be asked and answered. And framed that way explained a lot to me about why this bond that we form with our dogs is so profound, because we have to create a language that no one else will hear. I mean, how many times have we all met somebody else's dog and gone, why are they so crazy about that dog? I don't understand. They're just nuts about that dog. Seems like an ordinary dog to me, right? But what's happened, of course, is that they have developed this sort of language in which they can talk about the world in a way that is aside from human language, but is still something very much like a language. So that was the first thing I read where I went, oh, finally somebody is talking about something that feels like it's been neglected. I ultimately ended up drawing on a book called Working Dogs, which was an account of the Fortunate Fields Project. I don't know if this is something you're familiar with.
No, that was mentioned in your press material, and I was curious to hear more about it.
Fortunate Fields was a project that took place in, I believe, somewhere around Geneva, but it was a precursor to the Seeing Eye program.
Okay.
And there was a woman who was wealthy and thought she had a German Shepherd that was absolutely extraordinary and thought the world should have more of these dogs. Mm-hmm. And she, working with the folks who wrote the book, are Humphrey and Warner, they began a breeding program where they actually looked for foundation stock within a certain radius of her estate, which was called Fortunate Fields. And as scientifically as they could, tested this foundation stock, measured them, and then literally tried to create a new breed of dog that was inspired by her dog. I can't remember the dog's name. And their stated goal was to create a strain of dogs. I've always loved this phrasing. To create a strain of dogs that was peculiarly able to profit by instruction.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Like not just able to profit by instruction, but peculiarly able to profit by instruction. And as a writer, that phrase to me was so evocative. It posed so many narrative questions that it really sort of set me off to the races. Like, I understand what it means to profit by instruction. That's obvious. But to be peculiarly able, what would that mean in a dog to be peculiarly able? What would that look like? How would that manifest in practice? And being interested in writing a novel, that was the framework in which I decided I wanted to explore that idea. I mean, since then, of course, I have a huge bookshelf of materials. And I've drawn a lot on the Scott and Fuller studies, the genetics and the social behavior of dog. I read these books, but then what I extract from them are the photographs of, for instance, the mazes and ramps and all the testing environments that they would use to test the dogs to see, you know, Scott and Fuller were basically trying to answer the same question. How much of dog behavior is heritable and how much isn't? So obviously foundational stuff for all of animal breedings since then.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Hey, you guys. Purina Pro Plan is introducing Ultra Soft Puppy Starter Mousse. Yay! If you're looking for a food to help puppies transition to their first solid dry food, Puppy Starter Mousse is a soft, highly palatable wet food that offers advanced nutrition for the puppy life stage. It is an ideal food to supplement a weaning plan for puppies 3 weeks of age and older. The mousse-like consistency makes Puppy Starter Mousse easy for puppies to eat and digest. Puppy Starter Mousse is a convenient wet food option available in a 5.5-ounce chicken entree. Pro Plan Puppy Starter Mousse debuts June 2nd, whoop whoop, at PetSmart, Chewy, and Amazon. Choose Pro Plan Puppy Starter Mousse as you transition puppies to a lifetime of optimal nutrition. All right, you guys, I know I've been talking about this a lot, but I just want to make sure everybody hears about it. I know every pet owner out there has questions about their pet's health. The Marty and Laura Show is here to help. Hosted by Dr. Marty and I, the new podcast delivers fun, fact-based conversations about all things pet health, whether it's a runny puppy nose or a kitty cough. This show is really designed for your puppy buyers, for your friends, for your non-dog folks in your life, you know, your cousins, uncles, brothers, girlfriend. So feel free to share this on. We encourage you to use this as a great resource for the non-dog people in your life. Talk on.
It's an ongoing conversation, right? Like, we're still discussing this.
It's fascinating, right? The current, I think, generally nuanced understanding of nature versus nurture is that nature manifests according to nurture under certain conditions, but it's not at all simple. And the interaction between nature and nurture is what's so fascinating in every individual case.
It's like flipping on light switches. Right? You can't turn on a light switch if there's no switch there to turn on.
Right. Exactly. And of course, connected to all this is my continued fascination about how this happened in the first place, right? We have this extraordinary relationship with dogs, unlike any other animal. It's analogous to our relationship with other animals, but dogs were first, and it's, I believe, deepest, whatever this connection is with dogs. And in effect, we live with aliens. I mean, in a sort of science fiction scenario, you'd go, well, here's a culture that lives with, they're not just this species, but these two species live together, and they clearly co-evolved, and that's a setting for a science fiction story, but that's our life. That's the way things are for us normally. So how did that happen, right?
You just literally set up the segue into my next question.
You're welcome. Beautiful. You're welcome.
Beautiful. We are synced up already. The notion, and I've had other guests that have talked about this and the coevolution and all that, but I just love your literary perspective. We've changed dogs and they've changed us. Mm-hmm. So that coevolution concept, speak on that for a minute.
I remember going to a talk, Temple Grandin was giving a talk nearby, I went to see it. And she just stated it flatly, like, it's clear that human beings and dogs co-evolved, and that we would be different if not for dogs, and they would obviously be different if not for us. And she took it as a sort of as axiomatic. And I asked her about it later, and I wish I would have had a chance to talk to her more. There was a lot of people in line waiting to talk to her.
She is popular.
Yes, and not particularly comfortable when people line up to talk to her. So I didn't want to make her any more uncomfortable. But I did sort of come and say, how did you come to that conclusion? And her answer was basically, it's patently obvious. So I wish there was more definitive studies right now on how it happened. I mean, I think we understand that dogs were quote unquote domesticated / domesticated us at different points, a couple of different places at a couple of different times. Mm-hmm. But it's really been an exercise of the imagination for me. So there's a chapter in Familiaris in which I basically walk through the scenario that I think is the way it actually worked. And the sort of scenario that seems most likely to me is that, you know, the first wolves that approached us because they were interested in our garbage dumps. Mm-hmm. And so they were self-selected as those that could tolerate proximity to us best. So that's one side of the equation. But the other side of the equation is who got selected out of our population that had the most tolerance for being near wolves, right? Because they had to work both ways.
So fascinating. That is interesting.
So that's the, if we're talking about coevolution, then the same forces are acting on both directions, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a chapter marks almost exactly the midpoint in Familiaris in which there's a sort of flashback to a long time ago and a narrative version of my theory of how that happened.
I love that. That is really, I don't think people have spent enough time thinking about the human side of that, right? ones of us, and does it say we are more highly evolved? Like, I mean, multiple people over the world have said, if you don't like dogs, you're not a good person, right? I mean, so that's a fascinating thought, right?
Right.
A little spin back. What was like the breed or the idea that was the basis for your fictional breed? Was it the Gal in Europe, or what were you thinking of when you created this breed sort of out of whole cloth in your mind?
The earliest drafts of Edgar had a specific breed. Mm. You can probably make an educated guess already about what that breed was. I won't say. And what happened was when I circulated chapters, I was in an MFA program at the time, and I would circulate chapters. And one of the pieces of feedback I got right from the start was, well, I know that breed and I think of them this way or I think of them that way. And so it was clear that any breed that I picked that was a breed that people knew would come with baggage. And so at one point I said, well, I'm a novelist. I get to make up whatever I want. I'm going to make up a dog breed.
People eaters.
And so I gave them a general shape and size of a working dog, underspecified them, and said, the experiment here is going to be, can I write about these dogs and not write a lot about how they physically look beyond the general parameters of their size and shape, and that they behave approximately like what we would call working dogs?
Sure, sure.
And let people fill in the details from their imagination. And that turned out to work. And honestly, I think had I not done that, I don't think the book would have worked.
Sure.
Because it gave people a chance to not just connect with the narrative events of the story, but to also install their vision of a dog that is peculiarly able to profit by instruction and what that would mean for companionship. Because it's not so simple that, oh, the dog is just a better dog. A dog that is peculiarly able to profit by instruction is also going to be much more demanding.
Yeah.
It's going to require more from you if you're going to be an ethical owner, right?
Yeah.
And my sense has always been that the one thing that has held every dog I've ever owned back is me.
I tell people all the time, it's not the dogs, it's the humans in any situation.
If I had spent more time, I've never found the limit of any dog I've ever owned. I've always run out of resources before I could do that.
I love that. So final question, and this is one that maybe you're not going to get asked a lot of other places, but talk about in the society we live in today, where dog breeders are not well revered. We'll just say that. In my experience, dog breeders are treated sort of like Satan on a stick. Within our community, that is the reaction we frequently hear from society in general. So how have you navigated that with a book that's about breeding dogs? I think this is really informative for our community.
What an interesting question.
Like I said, probably not one you're going to get anywhere else.
Yeah, and I love it for exactly that reason. I have to say that it's taken as a given in the context of these stories that everything can be done well or it can be done cheaply and crassly and for the wrong reasons. And this is the story of a family who basically devotes everything in their lives, and it's all consuming, as you know, to do this one thing right. So there's a sort of ethical presupposition in the stories that it matters to them that they do it right. And so the question that you're raising is not one that has come up, A, and B, it's not one that I've seen reflected in the readership of the book. And so maybe that's a matter of self-selection. But what I've seen and what is just incredibly heartening to me is I'll go to readings and people will come up to me. And the best part of all readings that I do from these books is that people tell me about their dogs. And so they'll come up to me and say, I have a Sawtelle dog. I know this is a Sawtelle dog. And they'll hold up their phone. It'll be like, it'll be a Basset Hound. And the next person will be a Greyhound. Next person will be a Great Dane. Next person will be a Dachshund. And I just love it. And I have never once heard anyone say anything disparaging about the breeders that they worked with to get their dogs.
And see, that is so important. And I think for me, what I'm taking away from this conversation is that we, as breeders, when we interact with the greater society, that we do a better job communicating what you've communicated in this book, the importance of creating something lasting and beautiful in the world, is really, truly why we do what we do, sincerely and to our core.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, if anybody has that kind of negative opinion, it seems to me, has not gone through the process of working with a breeder to qualify themselves to be a qualified owner, right? Because every reputable breeder is going to quiz the hell out of a potential owner. And it works exactly the other way around. It's like, are you good enough to have one of these dogs? Can you live up to their needs and their potential? Are you going to be there for them when they get sick later? Do you understand what you're getting into behaviorally with these dogs? Have you done your breed research and all that?
Just finished my book, okay, about my breed. I dropped it at the publisher yesterday. And there's like six chapters on should you even own a German wire-haired pointer? And that conversation is the one, you know, I talk to veterinary students and I do a lot of out into the public and it comes frequently. You know, responsible breeders are doing a service to the world, to you as a veterinarian, to you as an owner, to whoever. And the fact that that is a message that's represented in a popular novel warms the cockles of my heart, as they say.
Well, one of the things I love about the Sawtelles is in Edgar Sawtelle, one of the sort of family legends about his grandfather, and his grandfather is the main character in Familiaris, is that he said, we know we'll have achieved what we set out to do when the dogs pick the humans and not the humans pick the dogs. Mm. And I kind of feel like for now, breeders are the surrogates for that process. They're the ones who have to go through that. So all I can think is that anybody who has that attitude has never been vetted as a potential dog owner the way they should have been.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, 110%. Oh my gosh, David, thank you so much. What a fantastic conversation. And guys, Familiaris hits, let me just double check and you can tell me if I'm wrong. August 5th, is that right when it drops?
Paperback comes out August 5th.
Awesome. You guys, I know I've been reading Familiaris. I got to read it, but I'm going to actually have to own a copy of it. So thank you, David, for taking our story and putting it into the world in a beautiful way. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that.
My honor, and thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Hey guys, I am super excited about this. Marty and I have been working on a brand new series of seminars that we're bringing to the Dog Fancy called Pedigrees to Pups. And we are launching it with sort of a taste test on June 13th. Here in Grants Pass, Oregon, my hometown, with my local dog show. We are bringing together the art and the science of dog breeding in one place, and we're so excited. We're going to talk everything from selecting your foundation bitch and stud dog, to reading pedigrees and breeding theory, to mating and whelping. The event here in Grants Pass is a short little overview, 3 hours before the dog show starts. And on the weekend of September 5th in Hawaii, we will have a 3-day seminar. And the following weekend in Wisconsin, we'll have another 2-day seminar. And so if you're really interested in doing a deep dive, you want to hang out with Marty and I, ask questions, get one-on-one advice, up close and personal mentoring, this is the way to do it. Stop by puredogtalk.com, go to the events page, and you will find out about the event in June. And we'll keep it updated as we have details on the events in Hawaii and Wisconsin. We look forward to seeing you guys there and cannot wait to kick off this seminar series. As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.